One thing that is key when it comes to the calving season is having proper monitoring of calving progress, right? And that is what is going to determine if the calf is going to survive and how bad it's going to be afterward for the dam, right? So, you know, when we think about calving, we had two players. We had the dam and we had the calf, right? Mm-hmm. And we have to be condescending of both, right? We have to keep both in mind. And timing is key for both. So the earliest we can identify the cow need assistance, the better. However, if we intervene too soon, we also can have negative effect, specifically on the dams, right?
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lalamond Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm your host, Brandy Buzzard, and it's my pleasure to bring you the latest trends and issues from the best and brightest minds in the beef industry. Today, I'm very excited. We have a repeat guest on, Dr. Adrian Berrigan, extension veterinarian and associate research professor at Penn State. He joined us last year, and we talked about wonderful topics in the beef industry, calving, cow reproduction. And today, we are going to talk again about some different postpartum things in cattle and calving season beef reproduction. So it's going to be a great conversation. As a refresher, Dr. Berrigan earned his DVM at the National University of La Plata, Argentina, his Master's of Science from Ohio State University, and his PhD in veterinary medicine also from Ohio State University. Like I said, we were fortunate to have him join us previously, and so let's just jump right into it. Dr. Berrigan, thank you for being here with us today, and you know, what have you been up to since we had you on the podcast?
Well, thanks again, Brandy, for having me as a guest. It's always a pleasure to be here and just to chat with you about what's going on in the lab and also some insight on these topics that I highly enjoy. We have been busy. We have been doing a lot of things. We're working a lot in more on the personal training, sort of a little bit that what we talked about last podcast, different ways to train personnel on these topics. You know, we were talking about dystocia assistance or calving assistance and whatnot. So we're working, developing a few technologies. We're actually doing some virtual reality.
Cool.
Pretty neat things. Yeah, it's actually, I mean, I'm a veterinarian, so it's definitely a little bit outside my expertise, but it has been a great journey so far. And we're getting great feedback from the people, the employees that are utilizing this technology. So I'm excited on those lines and trying, you know, once we develop this to start getting it to the people that need it the most.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I see virtual reality coming more and more into agriculture. I was speaking to someone a few days ago and they were saying that they had been to a booth at a trade show. And like part of that booth was that you could walk up and put on the glass, you know, the headset or whatever. And like you could be immersed in this pasture experience with the cows. That's so novel. You know, 10 years ago, that wasn't something that you could do. And so it's interesting to see this thing that maybe started out as gaming, or I don't know how it started, but tonight kind of creeping into agriculture and how we can incorporate it. That's really interesting.
I mean, it's a really great resource for like entry level positions and also for remote training. So this goggle, and you know, I don't want to branch too far out of the main topics we're going to be talking today. But these goggles, although the fancy ones can be expensive, you can have a very similar experience with a cardboard device that only costs $5, and you use your smartphone device, and you can plug that into that cardboard skeleton, if you might say, and you put it, and you have a very similar experience, because now YouTube allowed to have a 360 view of video. So through YouTube, we actually can upload these 360 videos, and they can be viewed in this setting for you know, really cheap to utilize remote. So you know what we're developing. So we have we developed a few initial ones on milking training, and now we're working on a calving assistant one that I think is going to be really valuable for this type of approach, like entry level people that has not much experience with it, and remote, meaning that even people that, you know, you're planning on hiring somebody, but they cannot go to the farm until, you know, 6 months down the road. Okay, let's put this video, let's get it started some training before we even hit the ground, right?
Like I said, that's really interesting. And you mentioned the calving assistants. And so we're getting ready to go into calving season. For some of us, for many people are getting ready to go into calving season. It is mid-January when we are recording this, right in the middle of January, actually on the 15th. And so calving season is coming up. People are building those calving kits. They're preparing their herd or their barn or things like that. And so, you know, what are some things to be, what should be on top of people's minds heading into calving season in terms of, you know, avoiding dystocia and maybe postpartum care? What are some things that they should have as priorities?
One thing that is key when it comes to the calving season is having proper monitoring of calving progress. Right. And that is what is going to determine if the calf is going to survive and how bad it's going to be afterward for the dam. Right. So, when we think about calving, we had two players. We had the dam and we had the calf. Right. And we have to be condescending of both. Right. We have to keep both in mind. And timing is key for both. So the earliest we can identify the cow need assistance, the better. However, if we intervene too soon, we also can have negative effects, specifically on the dams, right? When we think about the physiology of parturition and we think about the three stages of parturition, we have stage one of dilation, stage two or labor, and stage three would be the expulsion of the placenta. If we go too early and we start assisting or trying to assist before we get into stage two, that cow might not be dilated yet, right? Or fully dilated. So by trying to get that calf out of that with a cow that's not fully dilated, we are definitely going to get cause some trauma in that reproductive tract with, you know, all the negative effect that will come to that dam.
Well, that's definitely like a big concern. I mean, they're not ready until they're ready for sure. And that can, like you said, it can cause a lot of trauma. If that is causing trauma, I can imagine that's a special situation. You know, what other situations would cause a cow to need special attention after calving is completed?
Just a quick follow-up before I move into that, because I was thinking on that and I just forgot to add it. But the timing when it comes to beef, I work a lot with dairy as well, and it's a different world, right? So there are people there 24/7. There are a lot of people that can check on those animals really often. With beef, it's not quite the case, right? So there are a few strategies that we can do, right? We can have calving pens closer to the house or closer to the main facility where people are. That requires infrastructure and some additional planning, but I always recommend having some sort of calving pen, which is smaller than the main grazing pens, and we can supplement those animals with some hay or some other food resources, but easier to monitor those animals. And the minimum that we would like to check those animals at least every 3 hours, right? So if you say, okay, these animals, they're supposed to be calving the next week 7 to 14 days, okay, these animals, we want to get them close enough that we can monitor them every 3 hours. And how it works, when we found a cow that's starting labor, okay, and that will be, so by definition, the starting of labor of stage two parturition is when we see the water bag through the vulva or the hoof of the calf through the vulva, right? That will be our starting point.
Okay.
From then on, we want to monitor the cow. We want to see progress every 15 to 20 minutes, mm-hmm. right? And just because of the dynamic of if it's different in this for beef cattle people, I always recommend to have at least check it like half hour after you see the starting, and then an hour after. And if you don't see a progress by then, get the animal in the chute and let's see what's going on.
Yeah, I've always heard that, and that's kind of what we practice is an hour. And if they're not progressing after an hour, then it's time to take action and the next step and get that, hopefully get that calf out of there. So, back to the previous question, thank you for that addition. So what would be some other special situations in which the cows might need special attention after delivery?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to beef, there's not that much after calving that can go wrong, right? The main, so we have retained placenta, we have metritis, and we know that. However, the incidence is very, very slow. I mean, Randy, you're a cattle, you have a cattle operation, so you know about this, you've seen the field. So nationwide, it's a 0.3% incidence of retained placenta metritis combined, right? And this is studied, It was a surveyed, published by AFIS, the UCA organization, where they did a survey asking what is the number of animals they treat for retained placenta metritis. Mm-hmm. And it was a 0.3% sort of like rate, right?
Yeah.
And even, we had the beef cattle, beef and sheep center here at Penn State. I work closely with the manager, and we do training, scouting training for the students. There's a lot of student labor here. So I do all the training when it comes to calving assistance and whatnot. And we always take a look on those type of things. And it's very, very small number of that. Now, an animal that needs to be assisted, an animal that had dystocia, those are going to be your high-risk animal for retained placenta, for metritis, and even for down cow syndrome, right?
Okay.
So applicable approach is like, usually an animal that goes through a normal parturition, most likely is going to be totally fine. An animal that has to be assisted, especially the hard pulls, how we like to call in the field, the hard pulls, right? Or the severe assistant animals. Those are the ones that we need to, you always recommend keeping those animals in a smaller pen. You know, we usually have these like individual pens in the facilities in most of the operations where we can have animals that either are sick or we need to closely monitor it. And what my recommendation with these hard pull animals, even though they look fine right after pulling, keep those animals there for at least 24 hours. So you can properly monitor. You got to make sure that those animals expel the placenta. You want to make sure those animals are drinking well. They are also eating well. And of course, you know, the calf is nursing properly, because a calf also can have severe negative effects from a dystocia, right? Mm-hmm. Going from the most, the worst one could be a fracture. Right, and that fracture really will decrease the likelihood of the animal to stay in the herd or survive, all the way to navel infection, right, or even less severe conditions. For instance, like being weak the first couple of days, not being able to nurse properly, and things like that. So those newborn calf had to be monitored as well. So we ensure the proper nourishment of the colostrum, because they're going to get those immunoglobulins right there in the first 24 hours. If we skip that, if we miss that threshold, that window, that's it, game over, right?
I want to go back, because you've been talking about metritis, and for those who are not familiar with metritis, that's a uterine infection. Is there any data, or do you know, has your work shown, is that higher in a certain breeding season? You know, like, do you see more cases of metritis in spring or winter calving versus fall calving, or is there no correlation there?
That's a great question, Randy. That's a great question. In beef, I am unaware, and my taking on that is that the incidence is so small that it might be hard to actually get to some meaningful data on that. So I'm to my knowledge, there's no data on seasonal effect on beef cattle based on the season. However, now in dairy cattle, realist, despite that most of the dairy operations, they are not managed seasonally, right? So instead of they are annually bred, or the calving just keeps going all year long. There has been a few associations with having higher rates of metritis during the warmer seasons. With that being said, there are no super strong associations, and because I just did an extension article on this topic a couple months ago, so I refreshed the literature out there, and there are a few studies that found association and others that did not, and appear to be a lot on the management, right? I mean, if we go to the basis, we know that warm temperatures and moist environment are good for bacteria, right?
Right, yes.
And if we think about, what are the main pathogens that cause metritis, they are bacteria that are mostly in the environment or in the feces of the cow, right? So we put those two together, it makes sense.
That
in warmer seasons and during the warm season, they're going to be more likely to develop that disease. However, based on, and this again in dairy, based on the research out there, it appeared to be really related to management. With proper management, season basically doesn't matter. One thing I was going to say that, a key thing to keep in mind is that most of the dairy farms in the States, they are a confined system, right? Which is thought of from what is the beef industry.
So that plays a big role in it, right? I'm assuming it's because you have more animals in a smaller space. And so there's more feces and, I don't know why I said feces, more manure and water and things like that. So that makes sense that could potentially be that way. You mentioned, we were talking about the calf there for a moment, and you were talking about the importance of colostrum and immunoglobulins, and there could be problems with a fracture or something like that, or an infected navel. Are there any situations, where the calf shouldn't be left with the cow, right? So sometimes maybe you got to tube the calf and get it some colostrum, or just give it a bottle to get it warmed up. But are other situations where it's best for the calf to not be around? I mean, share your experience with that, please, and research you've seen.
No, that's a great question, Brandy. Really applicable as well. If the calf has trouble to stand up or cannot stand up properly, I always recommend do not keep it with the cow, because the cow, not because she wants it, but because they didn't realize they might step on the calf and, injure that animal even more. So when is that the case, that it's a weak calf that cannot really stand well for itself, I'll usually recommend keeping it apart, close enough, right? Because the man won't see it, and feed that animal as well. But it's just basically to avoid any further injury from, involuntary injury from the dam.
Right. So that's an important thing. Like if the calf, you have to protect the calf, if the calf isn't going to survive, then what's the point of having that cow? So that's, a really great point about that. How long we don't have small calving pens on our ranch. All of our cattle, heifers and established, mature cows, they calve in a pasture. Now the heifers, the pasture is here at our home. So it's, but it's not like a smaller enclosed pen like what you were talking about. Forgot what I was going to say. Oh, I remember now. What in those settings where you have smaller pens or a barn, with a small pen, like how long is your suggestion for that cow and that pair to stay in that pen before they get ushered out?
Mm-hmm.
And you can bring the next one in. How long do you suggest, that everything be okay before they move out and make room for the next one to come in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. Usually first 24 to 48 hours is the critical time, right? Something's going to go wrong. So the most common thing is going to happen on the cow is either going to go down, and we're going to have the, sort of the down cow syndrome, which there is an metabolic disturbances, serological. So in the blood, the animals, they might have hypocalcemia, hypophosphatemia, some deficiencies on minerals and whatnot. And then, we have to do some therapy, but that usually happens in the first 24 to 48 hours. The same with routine placenta. The animal's going to routine the placenta, by definition, is in the first 24 hours. If the animal expel the placenta by 24 hours, we're good with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to metritis, the number one risk factors for metritis is routine placenta. So especially in beef cattle, if the cow does not routine the placenta, most likely the cow might be okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that it's always the case.
Right.
And again, the metritis, usually, metritis can be a little longer to show signs, right? And most of the cases will find signs between 4 and 14 days. That would be the most common range, right?
Yeah.
Meaning the main sign, the expulsion of abnormal fluid through the vulva, vaginal discharge, which is abnormal and defining a normal will think about watery, red brownish, foul or fatty smelling discharge, right? But you know, however, regardless of the metritis, let's say that you know after 48 hours we don't have routine placenta, the cow is eating, drinking well, the cow didn't go down, the calf is nursing well, it's safe to say those animals can go on. You know, with the main herd, and we always can keep an eye on them just for metritis later on. After that period, you know, initially, usually after the week after calving, the metritis cases might not be as severe, but they're going to be visually, they're easy to diagnose, right? So I think that would be the short answer. I will say 24 to 48 hours. If everything looks good, can go to the field, and then we can get another one in. Hopefully, we don't have any other one to get in there.
I mean, if in a setting where you're bringing animals into a smaller pen, maybe you have like five or six in a pen, and those are the ones that are going to calve soon, and you're just starting calf season, you need room to usher those out.
Right.
You've mentioned down cow syndrome a couple times. And so for those producers or maybe stakeholders who have never dealt with that, what are the warning signs of visual symptoms of down cow syndrome? I'm sure that there are like internal symptoms, right? But we can't see what's inside. So what should producers look for to be like, hey, you know, I've admitted the cow is probably down. Are there other symptoms for that?
Yeah. Well, you know, and if I'm going to put the veterinary hat and just the terminology, picky guy, I'm going to say that animals don't have symptoms, right? Because symptom is something that somebody can actually express about how they're feeling. Okay. Animals, you know, cannot communicate. So by definition, animals have signs, right? Okay. But that's just being like the picky veterinarian right here. But
no, thank you for clarifying. I appreciate that. I won't mess that up again, I promise.
No, but I totally know where you're coming from, Brandy, because we also have like subclinical signs, right? So this what the clinical signs is what we can see, and the subclinical signs is what we cannot see, but we can test for it, right? And you know, in the field, we're just going to only see the clinical signs. And a few things that we're going to see, I mean, it's going to be the super obvious case that is basically an animal that is prostrated. I cannot stand up by itself, right? Mm-hmm. We try to move it, and it's not going to stand up. But there are going to be some early signs.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to tell you.
So there are going to be some early signs that can alert us that animal might be needing some therapy or might be going down shortly after, which is going to be, we're going to be shaking off the limbs. We can see tremors of some of the muscles, especially the leg muscle, weakness of the animal, reluctance to move as well, depressed, not interest in eating or drinking, no interest on the calf either, right? Because, you know, a cow that just went through calving, she's just, it's all about the calf, right? Licking it, getting. You know. So things like that can tell us that something is off and might be go down shortly after. So those animals are the ones that we can proactively do some fluid therapy. We can do some drenches with electrolytes as well. All those especially if it's a cow that we assisted, right?
Right.
It's not going to hurt. And also, you know, it might prevent further losses on those animals and faster recovery as well.
Let's say you have your cow and everything goes as planned. Cow and calf have returned out, you know, and are happy and healthy and doing what they're supposed to. Once that postpartum period is over, you know, how should producers start managing their cows for successful breeding, right? Because it happens, you finish calving and you immediately go into, you know, breeding season. For us, we start breeding season like 3 weeks after our calving season stops. So, you know, what should we do in doing to manage cows for that?
Yeah, I mean, that is a little bit that a lot of tradition on that how everybody managed the reproductive their animals. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the most popular approach is through the bull breeding, right? Mm-hmm. So we basically have the breeding pens and we put the bulls with the cows. It's always important to assure a proper voluntary waiting period for the cows because we want them to recover from We want them to recover from the gestation and from the postpartum period. So that is also important to keep in mind. Do not put cows that haven't passed the stated voluntary boarding period with a bull. And another really key part, without getting into the repro protocols, because the repro protocols, it could be very simple as just having the bulls there for, depending, usually it's about 60 to 90 days or even earlier, less than that. Or she's having a more of synchronized, some sort of hormonal treatment. And those are, there are so many, and probably we need a couple hours to go through those. but you have the more simple ones where we just only do prostaglandin shots every 14 days, right? And we put the bulls. And also it's a little more advanced ones where we actually can even do CDRs or progesterone devices in with other shots such as prostaglandin and GnRH as well. Really timely. When it comes to beef, those are fairly challenging, right? Logistically. Imagine, what type of protocol you are using running your operation?
What type of product? Well, we do...
Protocol, like what reproductive
program. Usually, we have done we've done timed AI several times, but we've also done heat pad, like an injection, and then watch for like breed off of heats. So we've done both of those things. We also do a lot of embryo transfer. We don't do the same thing every year. Not because we like changing, but because we're always trying to find something. Well, maybe we could get a little bit better conception rates if we do it this way. This year we bull bred everything except for maybe I set up 15 cows to be embryo transfer recipients. So I put the cedars in, and everything else was bull bred because of my husband's broken leg. But this was the first year we've ever bull bred everything. Right. So usually we are AIing almost everything. And then maybe the few commercial cows we have, they would be bull bred, but almost everything is AI or ET at our house. But I don't know what protocol. I have no idea what protocol.
Oh, that's good. I mean, and again, there are many, but perhaps the concept I wanted to get through is that it requires a lot of more labor and a lot of more infrastructure to be able to, load those animals, give the shots, and being able to do the artificial insemination as well, right?
We've done something, I think in the past, for some reason I have sevens in my head. Is there one is there a protocol that has sevens in it? Like a lot of sevens?
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. I think we've done that one a few years. We've only been ranching like 9 years, had like 8 breeding seasons basically. So, but I think a couple of those years we've done a protocol that has, it's seven and something. So, but it's sevens. It's built around sevens. I sound like a real idiot right now.
No, that's fine.
I do a lot of the cattle pushing and the cattle movement and the stock, driving cattle. I don't make the decisions on what breeding protocol we do. My husband and our veterinarian decide that. So
when it comes to the different synchronization protocols, all of them were good. It comes a lot to, economical wise, they not might be much different between doing bull breeding and synchronized animals. Some people will try to do synchronization when they're trying to improve their preg rates, because you have a little more control on, for instance, the semen that it gets. You have more, when you have bull, you only have like these 2 or 3 bulls, right? And that's it.
Yeah.
When you do artificial insemination, you have a much broader range of bulls that you can use to breed your animals. What synchronization allows you to with time AI is that you're giving a chance to the animals regardless of expression of heat. And when you think about that, we have a percentage of animals that they will have what we call as silent ovulations, right? So bulls are a little better to pick up those, but when we're doing heat detection visually or with chalks by ourselves, we might not be, we're not going to be checked and we're not going to be able to get those. And even bulls, I don't know if there's any research on that, but, bulls might not even be as good to breed those animals based on they might be not as much as signs of heat that the bull can tell. But So that is what allow you to bridle the animals regardless of heat expression. And by doing so, you're going to increase the chances of those animals that have silent ovulation to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, it comes a trade-off of a lot of like infrastructure, labor, logistics. Economic wise, I believe they're fairly similar. Mm-hmm. But it's always, you know, it's always good to keep changing things a little bit, just to see if we can get to the extra, you know, to the extra level, the extra step, you know, the hair step. Okay, we're here. Yeah, let's try this and see if we can get a little better. Mm-hmm. But always, I'm a firm believer also, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
Yeah.
So that phrase as well. But, you know, we have different goals, and that's important to have clear goals on where you want to go. Based on that, you can define, you know, if you need to change or not, or maybe, as you say, it might be a good time to try something new in those areas.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. If it's not broken, you know, why mess with it? I know there's so many protocols. What do you know, maybe what the most common ones used are? Is there one that's kind of like the gold standard? Is there one that people use as kind of their intro to AI? You know, what do you think on that?
Yeah, well, I will say that the intro to AI will be the more simplistic one, which is basically the prostaglandin injection. And is basically a prostaglandin injection every 14 days, right? And basically the prostaglandin, what it's going to do is going to cause the lysis of the CL, the corpus luteus. Okay. And a few days after, the animals should ovulate and should express heat. So basically you give that, and then you watch for signs of heat, and then you breed those animals. Or you just leave the bulls there, and the bull will do the work for you, right? It works either way.
Yeah.
That's the most simplistic one, right? What you do by doing that, right? What is the difference between doing that and doing nothing? The difference between doing that and doing nothing is that prostaglandin shot might help get some cows restarted, get some cows into the cycling, right? We have also certain animals that are going to be an ovular, meaning that they just get stuck into after gestation, after calving, they never restart the estrous cycle.
Oh, okay.
Right, and those are called anovular because in the ovaries, there's not a structure. There's just only small follicles. She's not cycling, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes these prostaglandin shots can help restart that, although the most effective protocols on these lines were the ones that have a progesterone device, a seeder in it, and then you know, when it's removed, we can do a general shot, and that is usually works fairly good. But also this prostaglandin, there's not much research, but there is some research that suggests that could help clean the uterus in case of there's some mild infection. The prostaglandin not only is going to lyse the CL, but also it's going to open the cervix, and that's going to help to empty whatever abnormal fluid might be there as well. So, you know, that will be the more simple one. And then we can go to the other protocols that, you know, require about, I think the more complex one, it has about seven injections.
Oh my. Don't tell my husband about that one. I don't want that one.
You know, I mean, research wise, they do produce better repro outcomes.
Okay.
However, it might be economical, might not be enough to justify all the labor and all the logistic and sometimes the headaches that might come with such a complex protocol, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that when it comes to the strategy, I always say that you will know what worked better for your operation. But when you think about doing any sort of synchronization protocols, you got to think about good infrastructure and reliable people, right? Because those shots, you know, the shot schedule is key. And if you give so when we think about synchronization protocols, we always talk about compliance with the protocol. And the compliance mm-hmm. means giving the right shot at the right time to the right cow.
I think we talked about that last time, maybe. Like the
Oh, we might have.
No, and we can keep talking about it, but that's very much ringing a bell of like, this, it doesn't work if you don't do it right and the people don't, you know, if you don't do it right. So please go ahead.
Exactly. Well, but that is sort of like the short take on that. It's just, those are things, regardless of what type of protocol you're going to use, those I always have to be in mind. And one thing, a benefit from these synchronization protocols, especially when you use artificial insemination with it, is that you remove the bull factor, right? And we remove the bull factor. There are many things to keep in mind with the bull. It's not only the cost of maintaining that bull, but also it's also all the risk of disease transmission when it comes to reproductive disease and pregnancy loss that many of these, the bulls can have. Of course, every time that we have bull in the farm or we even purchase a bull, we have to do a series of testing to make sure that, you know, for venereal diseases such as Campy or Trichomonas, trichomoniasis. So we got to make sure that that animal is not going to give anything to our cows. So we remove that part from there. Brucellosis is also low, really, you know, we're free here, but there's always, always had to be vigilant on those, the same with, you know, that thing. In those lines, we at least remove that, right?
There's a lot of value to, or there's a lot of information about the trade-off between the bull breeding and the cost of a bull. And do you insure the bull? And the bull could break its leg the day that it gets home from the bull sale. But comparing that to the time and the cost of AI protocols and things like that. So there's definitely a trade-off. And even if you're doing AI, you still have herd bulls, you know, to clean up. So I don't know about the dairy industry, but I know that in the beef industry, you have cleanup bulls. So there's a lot of factors there that are you know, really, really important to consider.
Yeah. So, you know, you have pros and cons in all the strategies. I think that AI might work better for smaller operations when you think about, like, you know, dimensions wide and the labor involved. So definitely time AI I would think that if you're trying to start time AI or switch, small operations might be easier to get started there compared to a large operation with large grazing systems, and especially if you have the baseline infrastructure to, you know, do the breeding and the shots. And one thing that perhaps I can link to these areas, I briefly mentioned about the pregnancy losses associated with the bull, right? These sort of venereal diseases. But that's another thing that we have to keep in mind when we're planning our breeding program. We have to have a way to be vigilant about pregnancy losses, right? Especially the early. So when we think about pregnancy losses, they can be divided on fertilization losses, which is from the time that the animal is bred until around 7 days from then. Early embryonic losses, which is from 7 days to about 28 days. There will be early embryonic losses. And then the late embryonic losses, which will be from the 28 to 45 days of gestation.
Right.
Those are the ones that we most likely won't really see much other than the cow is a repeat breed. The cow is just not getting pregnant, or we have those cows calving later on, right? You know, the tail calvers. And those things, you know, can be many, many different pathogens, you know, especially when it comes to the early losses. The most common reproductive diseases that we have in cattle, we have, you know, we have IBR, we have BVD, you know, the common viral diseases. Yeah. We have leptospirosis, very common as well. We have the venereals, I say trichomoniasis and vibriosis of the campylobacteriosis. And then we have neosporosis, but we're not going to see much on those early. So most of those diseases can have an effect on those early, having some of those early pregnancy losses. Mm-hmm. So that's something that, you know, we gotta, the key on this part is vaccination, 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 right?
Yeah. Yes.
You know, it's like we have vaccines for most of them, but Neospora is the only reproductive disease that we don't have a good vaccination, although there are ways that we can control that. But it's a matter of just having a program that you will be vigilant, that you will be monitoring these losses in performance, right? That will be reflected on losses in pregnancy, right? You say, okay, the couch is not getting pregnant, or the conception rate at the first service, if we're doing time AI, is really low, right? Mm-hmm. What's going on, right? Or we have this large percentage of the herd is calving late, so it's taking many services to get pregnant.
Right, yeah.
That's something that's going to alert to say, okay, something is going on. We need to do some diving here to see what is going on. Is a bull? We actually have one of these diseases in the herd. What we can do about it, right? Because some of these diseases, when they get there, IVR and Neospora, you can have those congenital infected calf if the animal get infected in mid lactation. And then the heifer of that cow is going to be, carrying, and it's going to be high shedding in high concentration these pathogens. And you don't want to keep those animals around, right? Because then it's a really high risk to spreading.
Yeah, keeps going. And that's a good point, that it's one thing if one cow isn't getting bred, but if you have these repeat, if your whole herd is taking several cycles to get bred, like that's a clue, like, hey, we need to evaluate, what's going on and do some more deeper diving here.
Exactly.
We're going to have you on again so that we could talk about all the different kinds of breeding protocols, because I know that, you touched on a few, but you said that we couldn't because that would take us several hours to talk about. So we're going to have to do another episode about the ins and outs of AI breeding and the different protocols and the benefits of those, because I find that really fascinating how a few days and a different injection can really change outcomes. I find that really interesting. So
it's time for our famous three.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virvac's new Bovigen Platinum Vaccines. These four vaccines deliver quality protection against respiratory and reproductive diseases in the vaccine combinations you need to protect cattle at every life stage. Bovigen Platinum Vaccines are comprehensive and safe, have consistent supply made in the United States, and are backed by a 6-month guarantee in the Bovigen Platinum Protection Program. Start your platinum protection at us.virvac.com/platinum protection or contact your Virvac representative.
But for now, we're going to transition to our closing questions. You have answered these before because we ask those of every guest. And I don't know, to our listening audience, I don't know what he's going to say because this is a new episode, but we're going to ask him anyway. So what is your favorite beef or cattle related resource? And as a reminder, it can be a book or a website. It could be a person, a pamphlet. It could be anything.
Well, I mentioned about the Veterinary of North America issues that they have. They do those every 4 or 5 years. So that still is a really reliable source of information for me, where the brightest mind, the most expert people are going to be providing unbiased information. I also like to look a lot about this APHIS organization from UCA, right? Sort of the monitoring. They have a really nice articles here and there where they can talk about specific diseases, specific losses, or specific trends in the industry. So I always try to stay up to date to that. And another of my best, the sort of experiential knowledge that I really like is talking to my producers. I always try to connect as often as I can and just give a call and see what's going on. And I will stop by if I'm close by, I'm visiting a farmer. Oh, yeah, so this farmer is here. It's just going to stop by to say hi. Because that really keeps me up to what's going on in the field, right? Sometimes we get so much into the articles, into the media, and we lose track of reality. So, I always had that. Mm-hmm. I even was advised early in my career by a mentor, like always keep the eyes on the real world. Research is good, but we cannot lose track of what is actually happening in the field. And with that in mind, I always try to get out there as much as possible and just converse and talked about what's going on.
I think that's good. I mean, that's great advice, because you can, it's so easy to ignore what's going on practically and out in the field and on a farm or a ranch. And so that's great, you know, to be with those producers and meet them where they're at. That's wonderful. So to transition, what is your favorite non-beef or cattle related book? Or if, you know, if you don't have a favorite, what's one that you're reading, a book you're reading right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually read two audio books because I went to Virginia last week for some research with colleagues there. And I like ghosty stories. I'm sort of like ghosts. Like the afterlife sort of ghosts. Oh, like, okay. You know, what actually happened when the lights turn off in our brains? So where are we going? Yeah. So that's interesting to me. And also I'm big time now in nutrition. And I think I mentioned that a little bit last time.
I think so.
You know, like we talk about the carbs and I made you feel bad a little bit last time.
Yeah, no, we did. Yes, we, it's okay. I have not stopped eating carbs. It's, don't feel bad.
You know, Randy, it's just not possible because everything that you can imagine, it has the carbs on it. It's just trying to minimize it. I think that has been my approach this day, because I try, but it's just, you're just gonna leave eating like you know, I get to the point that you it's not diverse enough if you don't get any carbs in your diet. But anyhow, without branching too far, those are sort of like my fun stuff to read these days.
Yeah, that's good to have non-industry related reading. I'm a big proponent of that. I'm still going to keep eating the carbs, but I do eat a lot of fruit. So I'm going to maintain that. I think yesterday I ate 3 apples. So I'm good on the gut. I just really like apples.
I know. I love apples too. Yeah. It's okay. A great snack.
Yeah, it's great. Okay. So when you think of someone you admire or look up to, what is a characteristic they possess that has led them to be successful?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'm still sticking with the thinking out of the box personality, mm-hmm. Being proactive, being driven. And I think that one thing that I even implement more for myself is being goal-oriented. Sometimes mm-hmm. we have a goal, but it's just sort of like a fuss. Goal, mm-hmm. it's not identified enough. It's not descriptive enough, and sometimes we lose track of that goal. So just having really well defined goals and knowing where you're going, and the best way, I actually read this in a book about sort of like leadership and improving yourself, but it was about the importance of, I'm losing track of the thought. They compare it to a boat, right? That is in the sea and does not have a destination. What that boat's going to do compared to a boat that is going to a specific place, you're right?
Yeah.
So the boat that has no destination, she's going to circle around and she's wandering around with no path. The other one is just going to go straight to the destination and you're going to reach that goal much faster, right? Uh-huh. So you compare it to that and it really resonates with me because it's totally right. If you don't know where you're going, you might not get there.
Yeah.
So it's something that I admire for people that they're really goal-oriented and they have well-defined goals, because that allows you to be more efficient and better at your work and at your life as well.
That's a great analogy, the ship. I really like that a lot.
Yeah, I thought the same. Yeah, I really like it when the author.
You know, rather than hearing someone say, you need to set goals, that's a really good visual, you know, for why to set goals. I love that. That's wonderful. Every time I think about goals, I'm going to think about that ship now.
There you go.
Well, I'm gonna be on the ocean. That's great. Well, Dr. Berrigan, that is all the questions and time we have for this episode. We will be sure to have you on again. But thank you so much for joining us today. If listeners have any questions for you or want to learn more from you or about our discussion today, where can they do that?
Yeah, well, thanks again, Brandy, for the invitation. And yeah, we definitely can do another one a year or two after about the repro protocols, because there are so many that we can spend another hour talking about them. But yeah, if somebody have any questions or want to look at, you know, what's going on in the lab, we're very active on LinkedIn. And there is all my contact information. And if not, I always available through email. My email is A as in Apple, X as in Xavier, B as in Boy, 779 at BSU from Penn State University.edu. So they can send me an email and we can chat about whatever thing I can help with. Always happy to, even if they want to just comment on any experience, I always happy to hear, you know, those odd experiences. As a veterinarian, I help quite a few of those, especially when it comes to assisting dystocia, weird cases that we have had. So always happy to listen to those as well. So anyhow, feel free to reach out. Always happy to chat.
Thank you again for being here, Dr. Berrigan. And to our guests or to our audience, thank you for being here. Thank you for tuning in. And we will meet you back here next week on the Beef Podcast.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.